Hey guys. Morning. So, I'm Steph. I work at Red Hat, and I've been involved in GNOME now for I think 7 years. What really draws me to GNOME is the focus on making stuff usable. And for me, that's the paradox between security and usability. They're often at odds, but I love the challenge of making them work together. We're going to first cover some abstract concepts or some principles that you can apply when writing security features in your software, and then some examples of how we're implementing and applying those principles. We're going to cover a bunch of different topics, so feel free to interrupt if you want. If you want to get your question in while we're on topic, I might tell you that it's going to be answered, but no loss there. So, when working with security, or just in general, as developers, we often have this abstract concept of the user, this mythical being. And as security guys, we kind of sometimes shake our heads at the user. He's always clicking on stuff he's not supposed to be clicking on, right? Installing shitty software and falling for phishing and so on and so forth. But we kind of fail to remember that the user is a human. Humans are intelligent, fun, creative, crazy, but they're easily overwhelmed because our lives are full of all sorts of information, full of choice in the world today. We have to choose between all sorts of little things, and then comes GNOME and forces these poor humans to choose between more choices. They may be possible, they may be capable of learning about security, but realistically they're not going to. This, we have to understand the user, their nature. This is one of the fundamental things we do in our daily lives. We filter out extraneous information. We're constantly being bombarded by massive amounts of information, and just even while doing mundane things, we're constantly filtering out the stuff we think we don't need. We should not be surprised when the user ignores something that we wanted him to see. There's a lot of discussion about this. We've all been involved in this discussion. Freedom is not equal to choice. Freedom is equal to meta-choice. Freedom is equal to the choice to choose. You have to be able to choose the software you run on your computer. You have to be able to choose to modify it. You have to be free to do these things. But you definitely don't want to be micromanaging all the tiny choices that these tools are supposed to be doing for you. Sometimes users think they want choice, but what they really want is meta-choice. So, if you force the user to be part of a security system, you're going to have a really bad time. As the professionals writing the software, whether we feel maybe we know all the details or not, we are better equipped to make the security decision for the user than the user themselves. And just like a doctor, sometimes doctors get frustrating because they present you all these different possible remedies or possible ways to treat an illness you might have, and they refuse to get involved and make a choice. You know, it's up to you. Well, you ask the doctor, what would you do? Well, it depends on each situation is different. And sure, it is. But sometimes you want a professional to make a decision or to make a strong proposal, a strong decision. You can choose to reject that decision. That's the meta choice there. But you want that from a professional like one of us. In general, this should be our goal. Like, in a security feature, the user has to identify themselves. We have to know who they are. If we could do that automatically, we probably would. But sadly, we're not there yet. So you ask the user for a password or something to prove that they are them, right? But after that, we shouldn't interrupt the user with security questions and security decisions. Now, there's a different kind of user, a professional. These professionals use different tools. The Yeah, that is how he looks. And so they use different tools. They look inhuman when they're doing their job, actually. Professionals have learned how to reject part of their humanity, essentially, to be specialized and do one thing really, really well. But we can't forget that even professionals, when they go on to do something else, they don't want to micromanage the rest of their lives. Even someone who drives a fire truck for a living, with a massive console full of all sorts of buttons, many of which, you know, you have to learn and be trained to use that thing, will drive home in a normal car, right? And he won't want to drive that fire truck everywhere. I mean, pretty basic stuff. So, given that, when is the worst possible time to ask the user a risky question, to make a risky decision? When they're trying to do something else. That is the worst possible time. You're going to get results that are worse than random chance. If something is really truly going wrong, let's say someone is attacking the user, and something is going wrong, and oh, they get a prompt. The chance of them making the right decision there and not just clicking through it and ignoring it or whatever, if you just did a 50-50, it'd probably be better than what they're going to decide. So, which brings us to our first maxim. Prompts are dubious. If you are coding a prompt or you see a prompt, you're looking at, you know, through your software, you're refactoring something, and there's a prompt there, regard it with suspicion. Do you actually need to prompt the user? And this goes across the board. I mean, sure, the technology we have sometimes requires us to prompt, maybe to save a file or something, but we really don't want that. Like, our end goal should be to get rid of yes-no prompts or the equivalent stuff. But taking it a step further, security prompts are wrong. Sure, sometimes you have to prompt for a password, and that's an identification prompt, right? You're asking the user to identify themselves, and unfortunately, password is one way we do that. But in general, a question about security, like do you want to continue? Do you want to ignore this bad certificate? All those things. We'll cover some examples later. They are wrong. Almost 99% of the time. And if you give the user a choice to make that permanent, you're adding insult to injury. Basically taking, okay, fine, go ahead, make your choice. All right. We're going to keep doing that forever now. We're going to keep saying. All right, so here's an example. We all seen this. And the user is really ill-equipped to answer this question. I mean, completely ill-equipped. There are very few people who can answer this question correctly. Here's another example. I don't even know what is going on here. What software is being... I can't, even as a security professional, cannot answer this question correctly. Just cannot. Exactly. Here's another example. I mean, I could go on and on with examples. I mean, there's so many examples. So it's just game over, you lose. All right, stop interrupting. So what do we do instead of interrupting? We let the user express their intent, what they want to do, and then we make a decision based on that. So I'll give you some examples of this to get you thinking. This is a principle to apply. Figure out what the user wants to do, design, so that he can express his intent during the task he's trying to do, and then don't prompt him with random prompts, either confirming or whatever, right? So we all heard Leonard's talk about portals. Well, that was part of the sandboxing, right? Unfortunately, I missed part of that talk, so. But anyway, portals are a way for a sandboxed application to kind of call out to the system and ask the system to do something that the sandboxed application would otherwise not be allowed to do. Now, these are ripe for doing it wrong. These are ripe for prompts. And thankfully, we're approaching this from a different angle, right? So the classical example, which I think Leonard must have mentioned, is if a sandbox application wants to open a file that's not in the sandbox, ask the system through the portal to open a file. The system pops up a file chooser. The user selects the file. The user expresses the intent to open the file. And then the system allows that security access. At no point is the user prompted to with a this application wants to access this file in read mode, in write mode, I don't know what, and then continue, disallow, bullshit. None of that, right? So that's expressing intent and making a security decision based off of it. Another example, this is just a theoretical example. You know, photos have EXIF data in them. And you can imagine software that wants to, within our privacy campaign, right? We can imagine going through software and checking for this, that we don't upload them accidentally, that we don't sync them to a public service, sync that data to a public service. So rather than seeing a prompt like this, I mean, of course the designers can probably rework this, but we might choose to make the data visible. Make it very visible. What is in that photo? It's not hidden. This is the sensitive data that's in this photo. And just like we allow, you know, rotating photos and stuff, you might have a button to clear it. So it's very clear. The user has the data. His intent is to take this data here, put it online. If he doesn't like the data that's here, he can change it. Maybe take out that EXIF data or whatever. I mean, the principle is to be applied that the user can express the intent, is in control, knows what he wants to do, and then doesn't get these prompts to allow or deny access. So moving on to some more concrete examples, what are we doing to fix this? Here are some steps, some things that I've been working on. I'm just one person, though. And I know security sometimes seems like the dark side. But in reality, there's very few people who are actively working on this stuff. And so I would encourage your involvement. So the examples that I'm going to give on stuff that I sort of have planned out or have worked on already are no means comprehensive solution to this problem. And so we need everyone's involvement to try and apply it as you're making new software and help fix the stuff we have. So first, no more certificate prompts. I mean, these are the details of a certificate. I mean, I didn't even include the like binary details, which actually are the ones that you need to verify here. But barely anyone can actually go through this and double check that, you know, the certificate matches what it's supposed to be. This is what we're going to do, or what we should do. Just drop the connection when something is wrong. If the user is connecting, let's say from a web browser, or let's say an IM, let's say the server is not listening on the right port. What do? Do we display a big dialogue telling him how to change the port or to contact whoever or like some thing? No, it's a problem that's on the server side, misconfiguration. And we're like, oops, something's broken. I mean, sure, there are remedies that can be done. For example, if let's say someone doesn't pay the DNS for jabber.org, doesn't pay the domain registration, we could possibly put up a dialogue that says, do you want to send an email to the admin of whatever based on who is information and like. So why are we doing it for certificates? But. I hear these buts. Yes. So let's look at the use cases, what the users want to do, the user intent. Well, one big class is enterprise CAs. An enterprise company, an organization has their own CA, their own anchor, right? So for those of you fortunate enough not to know how this works, there's an anchor which is stored on your system, a whole bunch of them, right? And the website has a certificate that it signs the data that's coming from the server with. And that certificate has a signature on it by the anchor. And so your browser or software is checking that it's signed by one of the anchors on your system. So what we need for enterprise CAs is a way to configure it. We might have a link that pulls up a help file. Now we have a way to store anchors. This is already in Fedora, in Debian, in OpenSUSE. We have a way to store anchors across so that by default, all the different crypto libraries will use them. And here are some details on how it works. So you can see the various crypto libraries. Unfortunate that we have so many. So what we built here is this trust store. Now the trust store basically holds a list of all the anchors and blacklists, and it reads them from files. So admins can just put files in a directory, and there are tools to do this too. And NSS and GNU TLS read this information through a protocol called PKCS11. Now, some of the, we haven't yet retrofitted OpenSSL and Java to do the same. So in addition, as kind of a concession to getting this working now, whenever the trust store is modified, we also extract some bundles so that these kind of legacy uses of the bundles will still work. So the upshot is that an enterprise user or enterprise admin can add a CA and have it just work. So that solves like tons and tons and tons of the instances of the use cases where you want to use a certificate that your system doesn't yet trust. And it's not yet done, but we want to have in GNOME a user interface for adding that a CA to your system. Sure, it won't be in every application. The applications, as you saw, could include a link to help documentation if we want, but after dropping the connection, of course, and then you have your those use cases done. Now there's also professionals, professional tools, right? So we're maybe a developer is developing against a system that is just a test system that has a certificate on it that they just generated quickly, and in production they're going to use a good, like a signed certificate. Or for some other reason, you might have a personal server that you just decided to like put sell signed certificates on, and oh, okay, but you want to make it work? Well, there is room for professional tools to recognize that, to work with that. And here's how. Instead of prompting the user, even in professional tools, remember, the professionals are users too. They also ignore information. I know I have clicked through self-signed certificates too many times. It's just life. So what you do there is, don't feel like your tool needs to do this, your app. But what you do there is associate the certificate with the account, as you would let the user specify a host name or a username or whatever. And what that does is it does two things. This is how we can be more secure with less security. Does two things. One is it lets the user, you know, not get prompted later and, you know, work around the fact that it's a self-signed certificate. But two, it also lets the user do what's called a certificate pinning, where if the certificate that the server sends does not match that certificate, boom, it doesn't work anymore. So let's really micromanaging secure users double check the certificates that they want to use with a given service and pin them there. And if something changes, get notified. So, but not every application has to do this. So if you're building a professional application or something that you imagine needs this feature, this is how to do it. Instead of prompting, this is how to do it. All right, on to another topic, application password storage. So currently in GNOME, we have GNOME keyring, which is kind of like the central database of all the passwords. And all the applications can dump passwords in there, and they can get them out. Now, this is really surprising to users because it doesn't match their intent. Their intent is that they type the password in this application, and the application remembers it. What they don't expect is that every other application, including their younger brother using Seahorse, can go and read all the passwords. And in addition, it creates all these problems where we have one security domain, you would call it, for all the applications. They can all read each other's passwords and crap. So really, the password is part of the account info. When you set up a password in Empathy or whatever, it really is part of the account. Why don't we store it in the account? Well, because most people agree that putting a password unencrypted on a laptop disk is bad practice. I mean, there are some storages where you can write the password in clear text, like an encrypted disk or maybe a phone where you cannot, some sorts of phones where you cannot read the disk raw the raw disk for sandboxed applications. So we likely need to use some sort of encryption. But, and sandbox applications really throw a wrench into this, because if you have them all sharing their passwords, right, in the central database, you're going to have all these like, oh, this app wants to read this password, and all these weird either prompts or situations that prompts are likely to appear. So instead, what we want to do is have a session key in the kernel key ring. The kernel key ring is kind of it's kind of like GNOME key ring a little bit, but it's volatile. It only stays around on for the booted life of the computer, I guess, or while it's on. And we really want applications to store the passwords in their account information. So they use a library to access the kernel keyring and ask for a session key with which they can use to encrypt their passwords so they can store them right there. And they pass it through and store the result in the account information. And the kernel keyring, if we don't yet have a session keyring there, it'll ask the desktop, the secret service, or whatever, to either prompt the user or load a session keyring based on the user's login. This actually lets you do some really interesting things, where you can have policy, like the whole scheme lets you have policy where different applications, you could tell them, this application, I want it never to store a password. And so the kernel keyring always refuses to have a master session key for that app, and the app respects that and doesn't write its passwords in. Or you could say an empty key means store in clear text. So then you could have, either per application or for the whole system, a way for to indicate to the applications, just put that, lay it down in your account information in clear text. We don't want to bother with encryption here. So again, another example of modeling the user intent. We're keeping the password in the account data. And again, you have more secure, because you can model all these different things. You don't have apps interacting with each other, sandboxed apps especially, to retrieve a password from somewhere. Of course, there's the case where apps want to share an account, right? And the way to do that is through GNOME Online accounts or service like that. For sandbox applications, there should be a portal for that. And a related use case that someone actually brought up just the other day, so I thought I'd mention it, is people like to look up the passwords that they've used in an archive or a backup. So we might also have a portal or something for that to kind of say, I've used this password. If the user wants to be reminded of it later, store it. But applications don't necessarily use that to look up stuff. It's the user who looks up stuff there. And if he wants to use it somewhere else in a different application, he puts it in there. So another topic. When you log in to your GNOME desktop using fingerprints or auto login or anything but a password login, you get this prompt, which is really stupid because it's a password prompt. Right? So the user explicitly chose not to log in with passwords, and yet you get this. Now, the reason for that is because although we can authenticate the user, we can make a yes-no decision based on his identity, who he is, we don't have any secret data, like a master password or anything, with which to decrypt the stuff on the disk so we can open his password store and so on. So GNOME keyring stubbornly puts up this prompt. That's really unusable. The user's intent is to, on autologin, for example, to just have his data be accessible. Right? That's what he asked for. For fingerprint, he asked for, although it's kind of insecure, to make his data accessible based on the fingerprint that he's leaving all over the place. Right? So really, the user has made a decision already that says, I want to be less than 100% or less than password secure, and I want to, I don't care at this point. So, this is how we're going to solve this. So again, for those of you fortunate enough not to understand how PAM works, PAM has a stack of modules. And one of the modules, usually one of the early ones in the stack, will prompt the user for a password. Usually it's PAM Unix, although it could be the SSSD component, PAM SSS, and so on. So what we really want is that password to come from somewhere else. First of all, we want all accounts to have a password, but then the user can choose not to use that password. So when configuring fingerprint auth or auto login or PIN login even, the user's password is written to a file. And ideally that file would be secured via something on the hardware, like a TPM chip, or put an NVRAM or something. But if not, it will be written in clear text. And this is the user's explicit choice. In addition, we want to fix the case where you unlock your disk encryption, and then you have to type the same password again when you log in. So both of these feed into the kernel keyring. The kernel keyring contains the user's login password in these cases, disk, PIN, auto login, fingerprint authentication. And then when the login starts, there is no authentication token. There's no password. That's what they call it. So the first thing in the stack looks and checks with the kernel keyring. Do you have the user's login password? Can I just use it? And it feeds it into the stack at the top. And then the underlying components see there's already one there. It tries to use it. And if it works, then no prompt. And on we go. Down at the bottom, PAM gnome keyring is also able to use that password to unlock the user's passwords, or to provide, like I said in the last step, the master session key for apps to unlock their own passwords. So we get a usable login experience that models the user's intent. And in fact, you get ability to use more secure stuff, such as your disk encryption, smoothly. So those are the things that I sort of have schemed in this area. But there is so much more. And if you want to join in on any of these tasks, I can break them down. We can work together. I'd love that. This is not my job to work on this stuff. I work part-time on it. And if you see other places where you want to apply the principles I've talked about, then by all means, don't be afraid of joining the dark side, the security. Bring us back from the dark side. We have cookies. So, here's your commandment. Terminate security prompts with extreme prejudice. And this is really interesting. I read this the other day. For every keystroke or click that the user has to use a security or crypto feature, the user base declines by half. So you can imagine how that goes. All right. Any questions? Yes.
Aren't you afraid that the web browser example, going back to that, we're just going to drop connections if the certificate's mismatching. There are some sites out there that don't have proper certificate config. People will want to go to them. Don't you think they're just going to find, you know, like more extreme measures of disabling the security system so that they can get what they want?
And that will match user intent. Like, I'm fine with someone who's crazy or someone who is kind of used to living on the extreme going and disabling half the security system.
Yeah, but if, like, user intent is I want to see this site, and then now you force them into, like, I'm disabling all security validation or something like this.
That's a possibility, but I think we've also made it possible for the user to fix that situation in a straightforward, secure way without getting a prompt interrupting them. So not only have we taken something away, but we've given them the ability to fix it. Really, it's been hopeless so far, right? You try to trust some CA or something, like CA cert, for example, and it's like, what? You have to configure it in every application. That's messed up. So what we're trying to do is really solve the problem that the users are actually facing. And there will always be some weirdos who want to ignore that stuff, or Or totally valid users who want to ignore that stuff. And fair enough. I mean, it's open source. They can go and modify it. They can reconfigure it. They can change it. But we don't necessarily have to present that to all the users, that option to all the users. Did you have a question?
There we go. Yeah. So with the decline of passwords as a secure measure, the current hashing rates, the amount of letters that a user can remember is far below the amount of letters that a computer can brute force in half an hour. And with the general unavailability of two-factor authentication, what can we do to fix the problem?
Well, there's a lot of research on this. The short answer is I don't have an amazing response to that. I mean, if someone wants to work on new authentication methods or implementing ones that are in research, that's certainly interesting work that we can do. I mean, if we have established stuff, we could try implementing into GNOME, but don't be shy when exploring this stuff. There's definitely a need for something better, but we don't have it yet. Oh. Sure.
All right, there we go. I think it's a good approach to try to catch the user's intent, but it's at the same time very hard.
It is hard.
I mean, with security, I don't know, it might be very differentiated what, you know, the user's intent is exactly.
There's no doubt it's a challenge. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk, is we're on the verge of designing this sandboxed applications, and it will be so easy to fall into the trap of getting more prompts. So easy. And I agree it is hard. It is really hard. Like, for example, do you want to share your location? Yes, no. What is the answer to that? What if you, I mean, this is just spitballing here, but what if you were to display a map and say, select your location, share button? Like, the user clicks the share button in his web app, and he gets a map and can select, of course, centered on his current location. And it's kind of modeling a task to do rather than a permission. I mean, I realize it's hard. And I don't think any of us has like this genius solution for each and every prompt. I mean, each one is going to be a challenge. But we really cannot just fall into the trap of prompting users that are just going to be clicked. I mean, showing prompts that are just going to be clicked through, and you kind of get in the habit of just clicking through them.
I think it is useful to make a distinction between prompts that are like, would you like to share your location, yes, no, versus prompts that are more like, would you like me to do what will allow you to do what you're trying to do?
Certainly.
I mean, like, when it's a straight choice, that's like, you know, if I'm clicking no, I don't get what I want, versus, okay, this is really a preference, and then I can proceed.
Right.
I think those are
or
really
how
two
do you
different
want to
things.
Do your task? Like,
yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the ability to, of course, stop it if it was a surprise that somehow this thing popped up.
So saying that all yes or no choices are equally bad, I'm not sure that that's true.
That's why I said prompts are dubious, and I understand your point, but we need to react when we see it. We, as developers, we need to react when we see a prompt and really think hard. Is this really necessary? And I guess that's my point. So we've been so used to just generating prompts. So perhaps I'm a bit extreme here, and there are exceptions, but it really should be our first reaction to think, hey, this is a prompt. What are we doing here? Can we change this so that we're actually matching what the user wants to do, or presenting like part of the flow, or somehow letting him show his intent, or something like that. Jasper's up there.
So continuing on Ryan's question before, my bank, which is absolutely terrible, has had an invalid sort of outdated certificate for 5 years, and I don't see it getting fixed because it's a bank.
That should be.
Yeah, I need to. I know, because they block my credit card here, and I can't get any money right now. But I mean, it's just sort of. I mean, I sort of agree with Ryan's sentiment that if like there's invalid certificate websites all over the place, like you can't just sort of kill their connection. I mean, obviously, right now, like it's very, very bad because Firefox shows you like a window that says you are under, you are being phished, you are being hacked, and the user's like clicking no, I want to ignore, I need to get my monies. So it's just like I understand your point, but like,
yeah,
I don't think there's anything you can do for just terrible websites or
first
stuff
of all,
like that.
You should probably not use their online banking system, but I'm gonna return anecdote in kind. And that is on the mozilla.bugzilla.org website, where people file bugs about Firefox, there are a number of bugs with people with that exact same thing. Hey, you guys suck. You do not recognize a certificate from my bank. I keep getting prompted and blah, blah, blah. And then someone looks into the details, and they are, in fact, being man in the middle. Someone is attacking them. And they had enough knowledge to go and post like certificate details and all that stuff on Bugzilla. So how many people are just ignoring it? I mean, a factor of 1,000 more, right? So I realize there's a trade-off here, but I think this is completely the right approach. And there are ways to get to, obviously, we haven't totally ignored the fact that all certificates automatically validate, and there are ways to do it. So someone might make a browser plugin for you, or you might make it, that says, hey, when I go to this bookmark, always check for, make sure it's this certificate, no matter if it's outdated or whatever. Pin the certificate to the bookmark, and there you go.
The other question I have, what do you think about SE Linux? That's the reaction I was expecting. Thank you.
No, I think there's a lot of good use cases for it. And I just think much of what we try to do with it now is too fine-grained. So it's, again, the tyranny of small decisions. We need to, and there's definitely work being done on this. I'm not trying to knock it. We need to use it at a higher level, a more... Like, for example, with sandboxes, that's kind of the abstraction, or with containers, or with virtual machines, that's kind of the level that you're talking about. Rather than some people want to micromanage, and SE Linux will always support that, but I think we're taking it to the next level now, and by removing all those tiny little incy-bincy intricate decisions and micromanaging every detail, you sort of have these bigger security domains where stuff in there interacts fine, but when it wants to interact with something outside, there are only defined ways for it to do that.
So I have two questions. The first one was, I think you were mentioning some alternative path that they take to be able to still access those websites by adding a certificate to some sort of store or something. Like, you first said, like, just deny them and then have, like,
right,
a UI that you didn't really specify.
So this is the infrastructure I've been working on. Actually, it's already done, the infrastructure. And this is Trust Store. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And the Trust Store is basically stuff in these two directories. So right now on your Fedora 19, your Debian testing, or your OpenSUSE factory, I think, you can put your CA certificate in one of these directories, or check the docs, because I think some of them changed the directory to be compatible with their old stuff. But you can put it in there, and suddenly everything will respect it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, user interface is very important, and I was really hoping to have that done by Guadec. Unfortunately, lots of other stuff conspired against me. There are tools, command line tools now, that's very new, to do that, so you don't have to like manually place files. It'll just take care of adding and listing and stuff like that. And then there are, based on those tools, we have to build a UI, for example, in Seahorse, that the docs can reference. Because I understand that not everyone has an admin, even in an enterprise, not everyone has an admin caring about their every GNOME need. Many of them don't care that you run Linux. So by having the documentation, how to do this, we can guide the user through these steps if they really have to.
Okay. And the question that I'm really interested in is, you mentioned like encrypted hard disks, but like when you install Fedora, it doesn't give you like the encrypted option checked by default. So would that be saying that you'd like to see, like, say, Linux distributions generally like pushing for people to encrypt their drives?
There's a lot of discussion about that. The problem is password recovery, right? Unless you can provide the user a really sane way of recovering that password, checking it by default is very presumptuous from a developer perspective. So I totally would love to see it checked by default, but we have to have a good password recovery mechanism.
You talked about how you would support sort of like advanced interface for pinning. What's your opinion on this idea of certificate pinning by default on first use, so that, you know, when I go and access my bank, it can all of a sudden be like, oh yeah, you know, by the way, your bank is now authorized by a Russian certificate authority. Are you sure that that's really what you intend?
Right. So there's a lot of work being done on how to solve the CA problem, because CAs are, it's pretty much a recipe for corruption, right? Basically get money for doing the right thing and more money for doing the wrong thing, you know. So there's a lot of work on this, and some proposals like TAC have a way to pin a key to a website, and the first time you see it, first time you use it, you kind of make a leap of faith, and thereafter you kind of build trust in it because you keep seeing the same thing, and there's a way to migrate to a new key, so not you won't ever really do that again. And it's an interesting approach, but it needs more work from the user interface perspective, because it really depends on the use case. If the user is logging on to, for example, it really makes sense in the case of social networking. If you are creating an account, let's say with Facebook, the first time you're creating that account, you want to know that later when you connect and add more of your personal information, that you are going back to the same website. It also works very well for ad hoc communication between people. The first time I met you, I had no idea who you were and whether you're trustworthy or not. And the same thing works with pinning, right? The first time I kind of make a leap of faith or kind of, there's not much at stake. But over time, you want to be sure you're going back to the same place. As far as the leap of faith when you're connecting to someone that you like your bank, that you have to know is the right party from the beginning, that is kind of more of an unsolved problem.
In the slide you have here, will I be able to white out keys in user share if I don't trust them from the files in its set, yeah, or is it strictly additive?
No, there's also blacklisting. So you should be able to take a certificate and say, never use this certificate again. Now, not all of those libraries support it yet. NSS is the only one that supports that.
Well, I mean, so that I can just strike it out of the trust store completely.
Sure, you can do that too.
From Etsy.
From Etsy.
Like, say I don't agree with one of the providers.
Actually, we do have a way. We have a way to do that. I can, basically, you mark it as untrusted for any use. Each of those anchors are trusted for various uses, like web or email or so on. And the tool would unmark, the tool does unmark it for any use when you disable it. And the anchor is still there, but can't really be used.
I want to say that this slide, like, I love you for it, because this has been a disaster since
it
the beginning
it's
of
been
time.
A disaster, and it's a real shame that it's taken so long to get here.
So this all looks great. It's fantastic. What concerns me right now is that there's a lot of us, well, not a lot, there are some of us in our community that are getting harassed as we go through TSA checkpoints, stuff like that.
Pardon? Yeah. I didn't hear that word.
Like going through TSA checkpoints, we get harassed, our machines get taken, they get imaged. What are we doing to prevent things like leaking, you know, our keys and memory? I shut my laptop, what just happened to my keys? Are they eventually going to disk? You know, a lot of the service stuff goes through DBus, so I have an application, it wants to get a password from the key ring, it may go over DBus. We have no control over DBus zeroing out the memory that contains my password.
Well,
nor
yes,
do we necessarily zero the password before freeing it in the applications. Yeah. Like, what are we going to do about conventions? How can we deal with that to make sure that our applications are protecting us even when we're traveling?
Right. So there's various aspects to that question, and one of the interesting things is like distinction between privacy and security. Someone was telling me yesterday, and it was a really good point, that security is often the implementation of privacy, right? So we have this privacy campaign. What I've talked here today was a lot about security. In our privacy campaign, we should be examining those various use cases, especially if our community has already run into these problems. And a bunch of us were having an ad hoc discussion about it. But we need to start crystallizing what we're going to do for that privacy campaign, right? I mean, I'm certainly not running it, but so if you have any ideas, though, I'd be happy to, Andreas or Tobias or Alan or myself, we can start a discussion on that. Like, what tasks do we want to do? Obviously, 20K is not going to solve the world's problems, but right. We can actually start to tackle some of those things. As far as the security side, apps doing their security, that is a problem. And I hope that part of that is solved by this. We have a much more secure infrastructure for passwords. They're not passed around the system. Although currently, at least Gnome Keyring doesn't pass clear passwords over Divas. But and here the password never leaves the app.
Presumably, the kernel keyring area is going to be M-locked memory, so when you shut it, yeah. No chance of going to disk.
Yeah, so and we do need to take some steps when you suspend your computer to clear the kernel keyring, and then on unlock, use the unlock password to re-populate that master session key.
As far as the privacy campaign is concerned, right now we're still gathering what we would want the community at large and see what we're going to be using the money for.
Yeah.
It's very possible that we'll end up having, just like for previous donations and previous campaigns, that we'll just have one company working on a particular set of tasks. But it's also very possible that we'll end up splitting up the problems into smaller pieces so mm-hmm. that Summer of Codes, OPW participants can use that. We can even make some of the stuff into GNOME Gold.
Right.
There's a wiki page on which we have a number of ideas already, and we need to flesh that out. We need to figure out what's the most important in the short term.
Cool. I just one comment on the privacy campaign is as we accept bids from companies or ideas or things, we need to. Security is such a broad topic. I mean, it means something different to everyone. So I think we need to focus, as we are, more on privacy. Privacy of the user, especially in light of current events.
It's a privacy campaign.
Yes, exactly. So if we accept bids from companies, we're going to get a lot of security stuff as well, and we kind of need to whittle them down to privacy things.
Under this regime where accounts or applications are storing passwords as account information inside of themselves, presumably in all sorts of different ways that the system doesn't really have any awareness about, if I want to change the key that's unlocking all of these, it seems that I really can't do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I didn't cover it in the slide, but you might have noticed there's a little 2 here, right here. And what that does is when you ask the kernel keyring to unlock a password that you've stored previously, you also pass in an identifier that tells it which password you used to lock it previously. When you're doing it for the first time, well, when you're storing a password, you use the current identifier and you tag it into your value and you pass it back. So that allows for migration between keys. So using this scheme, I mean, there may be more holes, and I'd love to discuss the details, make sure we have it all right. Using this scheme, you have the protocol, the whole model, has a lot of flexibility and a lot of power. Not necessarily that we have to expose all of that in the default install, but you have that.
Does the protocol give you an opportunity to say, oh, I see you're requesting like a generation 2. Did you know there's a generation 3? Would you like to re-encrypt now?
Yeah, I would suggest personally that we always have the app just have a well-known place to retrieve the current key when they're storing a password and just use that. The current session key.
Any more questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Join the dark side!